crime and punishment in North Florida. Angela Corey's challenger works to make the case for his election. Good morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. And thanks for tuning in on this Monday. Hope you had a nice weekend. I'm Melissa Ross. Well, just ahead, State Attorney candidate Wes White takes your calls. Get on the line now at 549-2937. Then later, how local children are getting a unique field trip experience on a St. John's riverboat. Plus, Cole Pepper on the Jags' thrilling victory over the Bills in London. All of that ahead this morning. But first this hour, State Attorney Angela Corey recently published an op-ed in the Florida Times-Union she said was intended to correct myths about her office, particularly its prosecution of juveniles. According to Corey, despite the criticisms, her office's procedures are working well and keeping this community safe. Now, Corey has drawn a challenger in next year's election, State Attorney candidate Wes White. This morning, we take a closer look at some of the issues in this race as Wes White joins us in studio and takes your calls. Mr. White, good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. Good to be here.
And the number to join the show, 549-2937. What are your questions for candidate Wes White? 549-2937 or go online to wjctnews.org/firstcoastconnect. Email and tweet the show or weigh in on Facebook. And so there have been dueling op-eds in the Times Union looking at some of the issues around the state attorney for the 4th Judicial Circuit. And I'll quote from Ms. Corey's recent letter to the TU. And she writes, "I have to make tough decisions. Sometimes those decisions are unpopular. However, I assure the readers that each case is carefully reviewed. Recently, the state attorney's office has been a target of agenda-driven individuals who ignore the truth and have repeatedly spread myths about our office's prosecution of juveniles." She goes on to say that a myth exists that her office leads the state and country in sending juveniles to adult court. According to Angela Corey, our circuit is ninth in the state out of 20 circuits. Of the approximately 3,000 juvenile cases in fiscal year 13-14, 75 were moved to adult court. She goes on to say that in other states like New York, 16 and 17-year-olds are automatically sent to adult court. There's more. We'll get into it. A series of myths and facts coming from her letter to the editor. As you read this, what was your response?
My response is that Ms. Corey simply just doesn't understand. She doesn't get it. The status quo is not working. It's unacceptable. We have young people growing up in this community who feel like they don't belong. They are not part of the process. Process does not work for them. That they have no future here. And they turn to crime. And when they turn to crime, we don't take the steps that are necessary to put them on the back on the proper course. And one of the things we do incorrectly is we use the rule of law to squash them as opposed to teaching them that if they comport their behavior with the rule of law and with our constitutional values, they will get somewhere. Instead, what we teach them is that we will use the criminal justice system to simply crush them.
Can you give a specific example of the criticism you're directing at the office?
Well, I think the Marissa Alexander case is a good case about how the state attorney's office threatens things in order to get things done. And I think Christian Fernandez is a perfect example. Here's a 12-year-old that belonged in the hands of the Department of Juvenile Justice. But Ms. Corey believed that she knew what was best for that child, period. And what she believed was best was a media grab and to charge that boy with first-degree murder. And I don't think there's anybody in the state of Florida who believes that that was a well-thought-out, considered decision.
549-2937 to speak with state attorney candidate Wes White. I'll go on and quote a little bit more. She writes, "The state attorney's office does divert hundreds of juveniles each year into programs which do provide services, drug treatment, counseling, anger management, parenting classes instead of court. Last year, over 900 juveniles were sent to a diversion program. If the program is completed, the charges are dropped. Since 2009, I have spent millions to provide diversion programs for juveniles and adults." What about that?
It's not working, Melissa. It's not working. What she points to is a relatively small fraction of the juvenile offender population. But again, you go to parts of Jacksonville and you get out of your car and you walk around for 15 minutes. Well, quite honestly, you won't do it. You'll see kids with pants hanging down around their butt or their ankles, and who have attitude and who will take advantage of you in a heartbeat. And the thing is, we're not addressing the core problems of these juvenile offenders. You know, when a kid touches a stove, I want them to feel the heat. But if I can avoid burning them or throwing them inside that oven, I'll do it. But we need to understand what the core problems are, and that is there is no family structure in portions of this community, and they're not getting the parenting that they need.
How would you then, as state attorney, if your primary job would be to prosecute offenders, how would you as state attorney get at that root issue?
Well, first of all, you have to make decisions about who is appropriate for diversion, who can be saved and who can't be saved. And as state attorney, what you do is you exercise your bully pulpit to get out there and say what needs to be done and what, you know, what is not being successful. And one of the things we need to do is we need to replace the traditional family structure that doesn't exist in large segments of this community with something else. And I believe it's faith-based organizations, and I also believe it could be charter schools as well.
549-2937 to connect with State Attorney Candidate Wes White. Okay, how would that work? We have a strong faith community. We have charter schools. How do you see that working?
Well, we don't have enough. We don't have enough. There's a need, for example, at the Kipp School. I believe there's over 800 kids on the waiting list. And it is a non-traditional school. It is a school that provides a need and which teaches success, a culture of success. And until we embrace their teaching methods and their ideals, and what they do is they tell every kid, listen, you come in there, you work hard, you be nice, and you will succeed. And we don't do that now. We have a public school system that is made for the average student, but not the problematic student, not for the student that comes from a fractured family or a non-existent family. But we need to teach kids, listen, you have value, and we're going to give you rights, but along with those rights comes responsibilities, and we can do that.
To be fair to the current superintendent, Nicolae Vitti, he has tried to institute a number of reforms in the public school system, including a parent academy, where he works with parents to strengthen families and instill these kinds of values. So is that a fair criticism?
I think it's fair because, you know, we're not doing enough. And this is a generational problem that has existed. And we can't simply ask the school superintendent to turn it around immediately. We need a whole community-wide effort to try to address this problem. And it's going to take years and years and years. And we're not going to address it by throwing every other kid in prison or jail when we can divert some of them and set their path on the right in the right direction.
I'm going to read a little bit more from Angela Corey's letter to the Times Union that ran just the other day. She writes, "What we are doing is working. The prosecution of violent juvenile offenders in adult court and nonviolent offenders in juvenile court and the diversion of appropriate cases have resulted in the number of juvenile cases being cut in half from 6,184 in 2009 to 3,161 in 2014. She closes by saying, "I will not apologize for doing the right thing while keeping you and your family safe."
Well, the fact of the matter is she won't apologize for anything. She won't apologize for botched prosecutions. She won't apologize for holding somebody in jail for 589 days. She won't apologize for the ridiculous charges that she filed in the Zimmerman case and how she botched that prosecution. She is hardwired not to apologize. And the fact of the matter is things are not working. They're just simply not working. And until we're willing to admit that, we can't correct them, and she's not willing to admit it.
Let's go to your calls now for State Attorney Candidate Wes White. Christina on the north side joins us now. Hi, Christina. Good morning.
Good morning.
Go ahead.
Good morning. How are you today?
Great, thank you. Go ahead.
My question was, my husband is a police officer with JSO, and Ms. Corey recently put on her Facebook page that she had received the endorsement of the police union, but my husband said he does not remember voting on that, that he attends all the regular meetings. And I was just wondering if anyone out there knew how she received an endorsement that the members didn't vote on.
I can tell you, it was a smoke-filled back room. The members were not allowed to vote on it.
How do you know that?
I know because of my contacts within the FOP. They were not given the opportunity to vote. It was decided by a group of people on the board of the FOP. And, you know, that brings something to the forefront, which is really important. The police officers and the state attorney's office need to work together as colleagues, but we can't be in the tank for each other. We can't hide when we make errors, and we need to be supportive. But on the other hand, we can't have relationships like Ms. Corey had with Nelson Cuba, a convicted felon now, and was engaged in a business which she knew about, which I tried to prosecute, and she wouldn't let me. We need to have a level of distance between the state attorney's office, between the court system and the state attorney's office, and between law enforcement. We need checks and balances in our system. That's what we need. And I'm deeply sorry that the rank and file of the FOP didn't get a chance to even interview me or hear what I have to say.
She will receive police and fire endorsements, however it was done. That gives you an uphill climb.
It does. You know, it's tough. But then again, I think most people realize that there does have to be distance between various agencies. You know, we just saw the city council get embroiled in a controversy with regard to texting. And we know that it was a member of the firefighters union who was involved in that and possibly acted as a mediator. Now, do we hear Angela Corey initiating an investigation with regard to any of that? No, we don't. We hear the city attorney coming to the forefront on the issue. But as far as the state attorney's office and Ms. Corey, we hear nothing.
Now, let me ask you as a follow-up. In her letter to the TU, she said agenda-driven individuals are trying to distort her record. What would you say to those who look at your employment history with the state attorney's office, your former assistant state attorney? You left after disagreeing with Angela Corey on a number of issues. What would you say to critics of your campaign who might think you have an axe to grind or an agenda?
Well, I do have an agenda, and she may have been referring to me, but my agenda is a united Jacksonville, a Jacksonville that's not an embarrassment about a profession that is held to the highest degree of ethical standards. Listen, when I was in Nassau County running that office, it ran like a sewing machine or a clock. It ran well, and we had the faith and trust of all the people. And the people that we prosecuted, when they walked out of that courthouse and they headed over to the jail or the Florida State Prison, I think you find most of them would say, you know, I was treated fairly, and doggone it, that white, he nailed me.
Let's go now to Mike in Nassau County. Hi, Mike. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. I offer my support for Wes White. I've had to deal with him on a couple of occasions when he was the assistant state attorney for Nassau County. And I just like the common sense approach that he uses to solve problems. On one particular individual, we had a young man that was about to go to prison that I was aware of for a nonviolent crime. And I went to Wes White and I asked him to look into it. And he takes a personal interest in the things that go on in his office. This young man, his parents were from South Africa, spoke very little English. He was a double major in college, and right now, because Wes White absolutely saved his life by keeping him out of federal prison and sending him to an alternative program, this young man is a contributing member of society, has a great job, is a marketing director for a good company, and Wes just used absolute common sense on everything that he does that pertains to that office.
Thanks, Mike.
You know, I'd like to think that as your next state attorney that I will do what each of you would do if you were sitting in my seat, and that it will be common sense. It will make sense for Jacksonville and Northeast Florida, and we'll move forward.
And if you're just tuning in, state attorney candidate Wes White taking your calls at 549-2937. Carmel in Jacksonville. Carmel, good morning to you.
Good morning, you guys. How are you all this morning?
All right, thank you.
Good. I just want to make a comment. I have a very simple business in a very blighted area in Jacksonville. And I can tell you that, and I totally agree, that whatever they're doing with these kids is not working. I have children show up every day at my business that want to work and learn. And I have one child in particular that's unrecognizable from February to now, to the point where his counselors and teachers were arguing that this was not the same child, where they even got the picture out to look to say this was not the same child, because of him working and the environment that I put him in has completely changed this child's demeanor. This child was arrested. He was in trouble. I actually stood up and went to court for him. And I have four of them now that show up out of nowhere wanting to work and learn. And they've all changed dramatically since I can't say no to them. And the last child was living in a hotel room up a Phillips Highway. I mean, it's really sad what these children are coming from, but whatever the programs are with these kids that have gotten in trouble is not working. I am by no means a teacher, but what I do with these kids is completely changed them. The one teacher told me, or counselor told me, that I saved this one kid's life. I said I did not save his life. I just said yes to the kid and showed him a responsible way to be every day.
Thanks, Carmel. Thank you. Wes White, the Jacksonville Journey under new Mayor Curry is being somewhat revitalized with the kinds of initiatives that she's talking about, finding more after-school programs and opportunities for kids, putting ex-offenders back to work, and a lot of other things. What about that piece of the puzzle?
Well, I can tell you that I have high hopes for this mayor. I think that his One City, One Jacksonville plan philosophy is extraordinary. I think Alvin Brown was a total failure in that regard. And we have a divided community as a result of Alvin Brown, and also as a result of a lot of practices that existed before Alvin Brown came to office. I think Lenny Curry is doing the right thing. But I think what we need to do is—
Well, Lenny Curry is probably going to support Angela Corey in this race.
I don't know that Lenny Curry is going to do that. He may do that publicly. He may do it privately. I don't know. But— If he wants to advance his agenda, he needs to look at someone who can unite this community behind the rule of law. And right now, we don't have that person.
Alvin in Jacksonville. Alvin, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Okay, thanks.
I just wanted to say I think he's doing a great job. And I know I'm a student at Strayer University, and actually they're having a symposium this Thursday. And, I mean, it would be great if you could come, because I know some of the issues they're discussing are juvenile justice. And I think he would be, like, a great asset to come. And, I mean, me as a student, I'll let my other fellow students know it's a collaboration with FSCJ as well. And I will let my, you know, fellow students know that, you know, I had the opportunity to come on this show and to speak. But hopefully he can be there. I mean, I know they're going to have, like, different panelists there. Like, I think, like, the state's attorney's office from Jacksonville. And also certain members in the community. But I think with what he does, I think he would definitely be great to come. Even if, you know, he just shows up, I think it would really be great. I think it would really help his cause.
Well, I'll tell you what, if you will call my campaign office, 904-586-3400, 586-3400, and leave a message about the time and place, and I'll do my best to be there. And I appreciate that very, very much. And I also want to encourage anybody else who has any ideas or thoughts or desires for me to show up, give me a call.
All right. Thanks for that. And let's go now to Larry in Fruit Cove. Hi, Larry. What are your thoughts?
Hey, thanks, Melissa, for taking my call. You know, your guest raises some really interesting points, but the problem he's speaking of aren't unique to Jacksonville.
Larry, get off speaker. Larry, get off your speakerphone, please.
Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Sorry. You know, your guest raises some really interesting points, but the problems he's talking about are, and I'll paraphrase them, they're nationwide. They manifest themselves in crime, poverty, destruction of the family, the lack of an income-generating person. And, you know, the real solution here is there needs to be fewer people being born that are in an impoverished situation and to single mothers. And in my mind, the best answer here is young girls need to be paid a stipend in exchange for having birth control and until they're ready and willing and able to have children. I just think that would solve all of these issues and probably eradicate poverty in two generations. That was my comment.
All right, Wes.
You know, I'm no sociologist, so I can't tell you whether that would work or not, and I won't even hazard a guess. But I will tell you this. We need to communicate to every single child in Jacksonville that they have an intrinsic, inherent worth, that we will provide them the best health care and the best education of any place in this country, and that with that right, we are going to demand that they live up to their responsibilities. Excuse me. Up to their responsibilities.
What about his comment, though, that these issues aren't unique to Jacksonville, that this is a universal issue for American cities?
He's absolutely right. They are not unique to Jacksonville. But the thing is, we have to change Jacksonville before we become a Baltimore or a Chicago. And we have an opportunity to do that. We have a mayor that can lead the way. And I believe I'm the state attorney or the next state attorney that can assist and lead the way as well.
Greg is in Arlington. Hi, Greg. Thanks for holding. Good morning.
Hi. I've been listening somewhat bemused to the conversation and in reference to Angela Corey's comments of an agenda-driven person. That's all I'm hearing from this candidate. And the agenda that I was most horrified and what prompted me to call into was a presentation that somehow privatization of our schools is some solution to the crime problem that we have in the country. Rather than supporting public schools, handing our private our schools over to private interests. And I feel strongly that I am sure if you follow the money, there is money coming from the forces behind privatization in the state to this candidate. And I will stand in opposition to him for that very reason alone. And he should be a lot more careful about letting that much of his agenda out into the public from his mouth.
Listen, I don't know who you are, and I don't know who you're behind, but I can tell you I haven't received $1 from any interest or any individual associated with charter schools. And I can also tell you this, that if I've got a broken leg, I'm going to go to an orthopedist. I'm not going to go to a general practitioner. Our school system is designed as the general practitioner. They take care of the vast majority of kids, and I'm not talking about defunding them $1. I'm talking about programs, faith-based community and charter schools and any other workable solution that can address that fraction of the school-age population that needs extra help. So don't try to paint me with a broad brush. Don't try to get the unions, the educational unions, to believe that I'm against them. Nothing could be further from the truth. My mother was a school teacher, and she was a wonderful woman, and I believe in the school system. But I also believe that there are unique needs that need to be met.
The election's still some ways off. You're the main challenger, the only filed challenger, I believe, in this race. Fundraising's been difficult. What's your strategy for that?
You know, I just spent 10 days at the Callahan Fair and received over 600 signatures, ballot signatures. And I can tell you that the vast majority of the people out there is an undercurrent of dissatisfaction and an understanding that the status quo is not working and it's not acceptable. So I'd like to raise more money. I hope we can do that. I will continue to do it. I spend a few hours every afternoon doing it. But on the other hand, I'm going to get out there and pick up the votes, which I don't think can be bought with money.
Thanks for joining the program.
Thank you, Melissa.
Wes White, a candidate for state attorney. Much more still ahead. Later, Cole Pepper on the Jags' thrilling win in London. Also coming up,
we're going to have to really rethink how we use religious language and think in terms of religious ideas in America in the 21st century. And I think the chaplains are not working in churches or in temples or in synagogues. They're working in mostly secular environments. And I think they offer a wonderful model about how we're going to engage each other in terms of religion, faith, and spirituality. It's going to be very different than it was in the past.
We've got a preview of this week's screening here at WJCT of the new film Chaplains. But up next, how the Riverkeeper and the local schools are working together to get local kids out on the water. That's in a moment.
This is the sound of drama. This is the sound of your community.
Good morning, and live from Studio 5, this is First Coast Connect on 89.
Stay connected. Stay informed. Enjoy live streaming of your favorite local WJCT and PBS and NPR content, all free from your devices. The WJCT app, available now in the Apple App Store and Google Play.
On the next Fresh Air, Gloria Steinem, who is now 81, looks back on different periods of her life. Her memoir is dedicated to the doctor who helped her get an abortion in 1957 before it was legal and asked in return that she promised two things.
First, you will not tell anyone my name. Second, you will do what you want to do with your life.
Join us weekdays at noon on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
November 11th of each year is the day that we ensure veterans know that we deeply appreciate the sacrifices they have made in their lives to keep our country free. Help WJCT honor our veterans during the month of November by submitting a name we may add to our on-air thank you announcements. Go to wjct.org/veterans.
If you love All Things Considered, consider joining us a few hours early for Afternoons on WJCT. The Takeaway offers a fresh way to look at the news, featuring critical conversations, reports from the field, and listener participation. That's followed by The World, with engaging voices to illuminate what's going on around the globe and why it matters to you. It's the smart way to spend your afternoons. Weekdays from 2 to 6 on 89.9 WJCT.
Relax Radio WJCT 89.9 HD3 is your music station, playing the songs you remember best from the Beatles, Elvis, Frank Sinatra, Barbra Streisand, and Motown, 24 hours a day, only on WJCT 89.9 HD3. Learn more at wjct.org/relax.
Welcome back. Well, it's a new partnership in the city getting thousands of local kids from low-income families out on the St. John's River. Some 4,500 students who go to Title I schools in Jacksonville will now get the chance to climb aboard the St. John's River taxi for a unique field trip experience. Jenny Busey is Education Director for the St. John's River Keeper, and also with us, Jeff Smith, Director of the Arts for the Duval County Public Schools. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
So this is a pretty cool field trip. I would be pretty excited to get to do this field trip if I were an elementary school student, Jenny. This is going to be happening, or it already is actually, I think, for almost 5,000 local fifth graders, right?
Yeah, we've already completed 30 trips for 14 schools, and it has been an absolute blast. I mean, learning has never been so fun.
And how did this all come about?
So we heard about the STEAM Cultural Passport Program for Title I schools here in Duval County, and we applied for the program, and were chosen to do field trips for fifth grade students.
And Jeff Smith, this is not your typical field trip. This is a learning. The kids just don't get to go ride on the boat. It's a learning experience.
It is a learning experience, and it's part of that STEAM Cultural Passport initiative that was started a few years ago by Dr. Vitti and our school board. And it focuses on science, technology, engineering, arts, and math. And as Jenny said earlier, Riverkeeper, along with 17 other cultural partners, have applied for that program. And Riverkeeper initially had offered to serve a few thousand students or smaller number of students, and we had some discussions and about capacity, and we were just so excited about their proposal and the opportunity to get all of our fifth graders out on the river that we decided to open this up to all of our fifth grade students.
What do they get to do when they're out on, it's a two-hour river tour, and then what happens?
So students are coming on the boat, and while they're on the boat, they're participating in four different activity stations. So we're doing some water testing, looking at salinity on the river, and testing water from different different points on the river. We're talking about location in Jacksonville and how close their school is actually related to the river. Almost always we can find a tributary right down the street from just about every one of our schools that leads back to the St. John's River. We're also looking at the ecosystem as a whole and animals and plants, their adaptations to the river and their connections to each other. And then we have an observation station where students are actually participating in dolphin counts. We're looking for manatee, we're counting boats, they're looking at bird species. And having a blast mm-hmm. while doing it.
And, you know, it's really important, I think, Jeff, to point out that a lot of kids in this city, we were talking about poverty and family challenges in the first segment with a state attorney candidate. A lot of kids in this city, if this program didn't exist, they'd never get out on the water.
That's absolutely correct. In fact, I went on the first trip, and it was amazing to see how the students were wide-eyed and mouths hanging open, looking out the river, because many of them, quite frankly, had never been on the river, had never had this kind of opportunity, if not for the STEAM Passport Program funded through Title I federal dollars and with the support of Riverkeeper and CSX in this particular case. This program would not be possible for thousands of students. So we're really excited mm-hmm. because students need to experience what they're learning and step outside the classroom, and this provides that unique opportunity.
And Jenny, it's just part of your mission overall to get more local citizens forming a relationship with the river.
Very much so. And I focus on students developing a relationship with their river. But we know the way students learn is through experiences. And so providing this to students in Duval County is probably the most important thing we can possibly do. Ideally, we would get every student at some point during their career as a student out on the river. Mm-hmm. And the students are excited to participate in learning when they're on the boat.
So it's underway, and you hope to keep it going all through the school year, right?
Yeah. So we'll be doing trips this fall, and in the spring, we're gonna shut down for the winter.
Shut down for the winter. Yeah.
Little chilly on the boat.
It's been so warm though lately this week. I guess this would be a good week to get
it
out there.
It has been. Yeah. It's been absolutely perfect weather. And wonderful wildlife coming through, and so it's been great trips.
And we had an interesting discussion in the first segment, Jeff, about charter versus public education. This is one example of what's going on, a positive example of an extracurricular activity in the Duval County Public Schools.
It is. It's another opportunity that parents, as they seek out what schools their child can attend, then can say, wow, there are 3 to 4 of these field trips provided from pre-K to fifth grade for all the students in our schools, over 30,000 now in this particular program. It's something, again, that's a highly touted program that is investing in the education of our children and their families.
Well, thank you both so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Jenny Busey, Education Director for the Riverkeeper. Jeff Smith, Arts Director for the Duval County Public Schools. And we'll be right back.
WJCT and the Florida Theater are proud to present Michael Feldman's What Do You Know Live. That's right, I'm bringing my show to Jacksonville on February 20th. We'll do the quiz, have some fun, enjoy a little bit of a break from the Wisconsin winter. So, do your holiday shopping earlier, surprise your Valentine next February. Tickets available now at the Florida Theater box office by phone at 904-355-2787 or online at floridatheater.com.
WJCT, the Cultural Council of Greater Jacksonville, and Grassroots Natural Market are accepting submissions from local artists for The Square. The Square is an online venue where artists share their work with the community and compete for a chance to be featured on WJCT-TV and radio. Submit now through November 30th. To learn more about The Square and to submit your work, visit wjct.org/thesquare.
Americans are economically anxious. They're worried about getting raises and paying the bills and getting by. How do we know? We asked for the first ever Marketplace Edison Research Economic Poll. But there is some optimism out there, too.
Stuck forever? Probably not. I'm pretty optimistic that someday I'll be able to pay back my student loans.
How the economy feels to the people out there living in it all next week on Marketplace.
Weeknights at 6 on 89.9 WJCT, community-supported public radio.
Welcome back. Well, it's a powerful new documentary that goes inside the dynamic and fast-changing world of chaplains, men and women who represent their own particular faith tradition, but are trained to be of comfort and support to people of all faiths or no faith. Chaplains airs this Thursday evening on WJCT television. I spoke about the project with filmmaker Martin Doblmeyer.
Martin Doblmeyer, welcome to the program. Thanks for being with us.
Well, thanks for having me.
This is a fascinating subject matter as you tell the stories of chaplains, men and women of all faith traditions. There are so many stories we can get into, and we will. But first, let me ask you, what drew you to this subject matter?
Well, I've been doing documentary films on subjects of religion, faith, and spirituality for about 30 years. And I know a lot of chaplains, and when we would get together and we would talk about this, I realized there had never been a film done about chaplains before. So I thought maybe we could change the profile, because day in and day out, these people do really quite interesting and remarkable work, and most often than not go underneath the radar for most organizations, and I think especially in the public's eye. So we thought maybe we could change that a little bit.
Sure. And you spotlight the work of prison chaplains. There's a chaplain on the NASCAR circuit. Lots of different aspects of American life. Let me also ask you about the chaplains in Congress. This is fascinating. There are two chaplains in Congress, Father Pat Conroy and Barry Black. Tell me about these two gentlemen.
Well, what's interesting is they have been chaplains up on Capitol Hill now since the beginning of the nation, and they're both well aware of the fact that their very presence can be problematic for some people who think that there should not be federal monies or state monies put towards the notion of employing these people. But when you see the role that these men play on Capitol Hill, and the way they understand clearly the role of a chaplain to Congress, you see that they understand clearly their own sense of history and who they are and what they're supposed to be all about up on Capitol Hill. Most people are fascinated with what they do. Some of it is ceremonial. There's no question about it. They do lots of invocations and opening of sessions, the prayers at the beginning of all the sessions. But also, too, they wind up providing lots of counseling and information source to a lot of the leadership in this country. And they do that from a religious point of view, also not only representing their own faith tradition, but to speak on behalf of all people of faith, so that they actually can be a wonderful presence and a voice up on Capitol Hill.
And as you talk about in the film, chaplains minister to people of all faiths and also people of no faith, right?
Yeah, and I think that's really an important distinction, because I think if you look back a generation or two ago in this country, most people probably would have identified themselves as a member or a participant in a particular denominational faith group. That's changing in this country. It's changing pretty quickly. The new studies from the Pew Research has said that the fastest group of growing group in America in terms of religion are the nuns, people who might consider themselves spiritual, but they don't want to consider themselves to be religious or any part of one denomination. And I think we're going to have to really rethink how we use religious language and think in terms of religious ideas in America in the 21st century. And I think the chaplains who are out there every day in these secular environments, they're not working in churches or in temples or in synagogues, they're working in mostly secular environments. And I think they offer a wonderful model about how we're going to engage each other in terms of religion, faith, and spirituality in the 21st century. It's going to be very different than it was in the past.
And how do they do it? What's the secret to being a good chaplain?
I think part of it is to take it beyond the notion of tolerance into a point of actually honoring and having an understanding and appreciation for the faith tradition of others. That's the big difference, I think. It's not just putting up with people who believe differently than you do, but actually learning something about what they believe. And in particularly, the chaplains understand enough so they can engage people in a way that they can help that other person find meaning and a sense of foundation in their lives that's already present in their lives, but just in the midst of whatever that moment is, whether they're in a hospital or in a prison, in the military, a lot of that sense of meaning might have been compromised or even lost. the chaplains there to help them reconnect with that sense of meaning. And oftentimes that meaning is in that other person's faith tradition, and help them bring that back out and, you know, find what they need at that moment in their lives.
As you went through the filmmaking process of learning and walking through the stories of all these different chaplains from all these different faith traditions and workplace environments, did they have certain personality traits in common that you noticed?
Yeah, I think they've become really good. That's a great question. I think they've become really good at listening. And the more I watch them at work, the more I realize that listening is it's a lost art in this country. It's as if we've learned how to scream at each other and shout the loudest, but those people who can actually listen to what another person is saying, what the words they're using, the language they use, and sometimes even what they're not saying, that's really a lost art. And so in many ways, I think on the simplest form, these people have become really trained to listen, to understand what that person is really saying, where the hurt is, how they can actually help without bringing their own agenda into the conversation, but actually honoring that person and what they're really looking for at that moment.
And you profile everyone from a female Buddhist chaplain at the Oregon State Penitentiary. There's a chaplain at Tyson Foods, a chaplain in Kabul, Afghanistan, a NASCAR chaplain, a Muslim chaplain in Michigan, all kinds of interesting environments. Out of all these stories, though, is there one that really stands out to you? That is there one story in particular in this film that just you feel really symbolizes the story you're trying to tell?
Oh, that's the hard question. You know, that's the hard question, Melissa. But I do love the woman who is the Buddhist chaplain out in Oregon, because her challenge is a woman working in a men's maximum security prison. Her challenge is really a much longer arc that she has. And in some ways, I think it reveals a lot of what it takes to be a chaplain. You know, if you work in a hospital as a chaplain, which is where most people do work as chaplains, you can be working with people sometimes 2 or 3 or 4 days. They come into the hospital, they're there for a little while, there might be a crisis, and then they're gone. But the chaplain who's working out in the prison system, and I connect with a lot of them too, and she becomes really a model for what they're trying to do. They're working with people who are really emotionally just ripped apart, and for what they have done, the guilt that they feel, and now to try to see how they can help these people over the course of sometimes 2, 3, 5, 10 years. That's a very different arc of engagement than you would in a hospital. And watching her do her work in the prison system, and the recidivism rate, the success that they're having, that I think is the biggest indicator. We all want to have data that proves that what we're doing has value, and that what we're doing contributes to something into the wider picture of things. There's actually data that says that this particular kind of program in the state of Oregon has led Oregon to become the most successful when it comes to releasing prisoners and not having them return into the prison system. So there's really something to be said for the chaplain program and the way they're doing it out there in Oregon.
It's a fascinating film, and we're pleased to be screening it here at WJCT. Filmmaker Martin Doblmeyer, a pleasure, and thanks for being with us.
A pleasure. Thank you.
Make sure to join WJCT for the local premiere of Chaplains and a conversation with filmmaker Martin Doblmeyer. It's tomorrow night in our studios. The reception starts at 6 p.m. with the film screening at 7. Tickets are free. Reserve yours now at wjct.org/events. Well, finally, this hour, the Jaguars end their losing streak with a win in London.
I'm a pepper, he's a pepper, she's a pepper, we're a pepper. Wouldn't you like to be a pepper too?
Culpepper here now with highlights from Sunday's exciting across-the-pond game against the Bills. Cole, this was really incredible to watch.
If you wanted a boring win for the Jaguars, this was not going to be
yeah,
it. Although
exactly.
At one point it looked like it might be. They were up to a 27-3 lead.
Uh-huh.
Then saw the Bills come back and take a 31-27 lead. But in the end, the Jaguars made just enough plays to improve to 2-5 on the season and their first ever victory in London.
How about that?
So let's recount the good first. T.J. Yeldon, the rookie running back, ran for 115 yards and a touchdown. It is clear the Jaguars are a different team when he's in the game than when he is not. The first half defense included a pair of defensive touchdowns, one on a Chris Clemens fumble recovery for a score, the other on a Telvin Smith interception return for a touchdown. Very good. First time the Jaguars have had two first half defensive touchdowns. Blake Bortles, late in the game, was very good. He was just okay overall, but a 7-play, 84-yard drive that included a terrific 31-yard touchdown pass to Allen Hurns was the difference in the game. Now, for balance sake, the bad.
Yeah.
First of all, four cracks at it from first and goal from the one by Toby Gerhart, and you don't get in. That's no good. Quite frankly, they should have put T.J. Yeldon in there. Let him do the work. Number two, the Jaguars surrendered 28 straight points, most of those in the fourth quarter, and watched their lead evaporate. This is a game the Jaguars had better talent on the field, which hasn't happened a lot this year, but they certainly did, particularly with all the Bills' injuries. And they couldn't close the deal when they were up by 24 points in the second quarter. Mm-hmm. It's probably not reasonable to say that a win for a 1-5 team is anything but positive, but I just can't shake the feeling that while this will help the Jaguars head into their bye week feeling a little better about things, it wasn't exactly a panacea. This is not a cure-all for what the Jaguars have had to deal with. The defense did get some more pressure on Bills quarterback E.J. Manuel, four sacks, but gave up nearly 300 yards. Bortles threw another pick six, although I don't think you would call this one exactly his fault, at least not entirely. And kicker Jason Myers missed another extra point. This win will quiet the loud shouts for Gus Bradley's head, but it won't entirely eliminate the thoughts by the barbarians at the gate.
But still, for Gus Bradley, a much-needed win. And let's talk for a minute about something you mentioned to me a moment ago, the incredible numbers for the streaming, the online streaming of this game.
Yeah, now the game was shown on television in London and in Jacksonville and in Buffalo, but everywhere else you'd have to watch it online on Yahoo, and they had over 15 million viewers online watching this and over 30 million streams, individual streams. So this would actually make this broadcast something between, you know, a little bit better than a Monday Night Football broadcast typically. Mm-hmm. It is likely to be, once they total all the numbers, the most watched streamed sporting event in the history of the internet.
Wow.
Which shows you, I think, that number one, football fans will go anywhere to see the football game. Huh. Number two, that there's enough technology out there that is ubiquitous now that this is something you're probably going to start seeing quite a bit. Advertisers had been promised about 3.5 million streams. They got over 30 million.
Oh, they got the bang for their buck. And it really was extraordinary to watch social media this weekend. A lot of people made the trip over there.
Yeah, and of course, a 9:30 a.m. start, so that changed things as well. Again, very interesting to see. I know there was a story in the paper about the impact that these trips are having for the Jacksonville business community. I can tell you that the Jaguars went over there much later. Instead of going on a Sunday or Monday, they traveled on Thursday. So because they had success, my guess is next year you'll see the team fly on Thursday again.
Exactly. All right. So kudos to the Jaguars. Let's talk college football.
All right. Both the Gators and Bulldogs were off this past weekend before the Florida-Georgia game this Saturday. But Florida State played Georgia Tech in the Little Florida-Georgia game. Mm-hmm. All right. I'm calling it that for now.
That's the Cole Pepper.
Somebody can
nickname.
Jump on board if you want. It came down to a wild finish. Final play of the game, Florida State lined up to kick the game-winning field goal, but it was blocked, and Georgia Tech's Lance Austin picked up the block and ran 78 yards for the game-winning touchdown as time expired. Big upset of the Seminoles, their first loss of the season, probably puts FSU out of contention to play in the Final Four for the national title, unless they can beat Clemson a week from Saturday and get all kinds of help. Big loss there.
Right. Of course, you are the voice face of the Armada, a draw in Edmonton.
Yeah, and this was so close, just a matter of minutes away from their first ever road victory. We've talked about that being the big bugaboo this year, that winning away. Instead, they settle for a 1-1 draw. Now, Sunday, they play their final match of the season. I'm hearing that they are anticipating a sellout, which would make for a nice story, considering they started the season with a league record crowd at Everbank Field. They can end it with a sellout at Community First Park. That'll make for some good bookends. Great support from the community this year, and they'll take on the Fort Lauderdale Strikers Sunday at 4 o'clock.
Well, good luck to them, and then let's talk for a minute about the most anticipated high school matchup of the season.
And maybe in several seasons. On Thursday, not Friday, but a Thursday, Bulls will play Reigns. At Reigns, at the graveyard, they call it.
The graveyard, yeah.
And this is the number one team in the state's 4A rankings. Undefeated Reigns against the number two team in the state's 4A rankings, Bulls, 8-1. Great storylines here, public school versus private school, speed versus precision, Northside versus San Jose, and two really good teams. They've met, because they're in the same district, they've met each of the last several years, and having called these games, doing play-by-play the last couple of years, these teams have played very close very competitive games. And, of course, Bowles has had to have gotten through Reigns in the playoffs as well to get to the state championship game the last several years.
Well, who's favored?
I have to be honest, and I'm proud to say this. I have not checked the betting lines for a high school football game, although I'm told they're out there somewhere.
Oh, really? Wow.
Yeah, I mean, this is one of those where I think you can kind of pick them. Because it's at Reigns, the Vikings might be a bit of an advantage, but I think this is going to be one of those classics. They had to move it from Friday to Thursday because of the Florida-Georgia game. They weren't able to get enough security to work the game, but this promises to be one with a lot of attention because it will be on a Thursday rather than a Friday, and it's going to be the game of the week for all the media covering it. It's going to be a heck of a contest.
Right. Well, good luck to both teams. Always great to see you, Culpepper. Follow him on Twitter, at Culpepper, for lots of sports news on your feed. See you next time.
Thanks, Melissa.
That's our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Sean Birch. Well, next on Diane Rehm, Democratic presidential candidate Bernie Sanders says if he's elected, the wealthy, especially those with the highest incomes, will have to pay more in taxes. It's a central question in the 2016 race. Should we raise or cut taxes on the wealthiest 1% of Americans? That conversation coming up. I'm Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT FM Jacksonville, your community, your world. Tomorrow at 9 a.m., make sure to tune in for a conversation with the CEO of Global Ministries. That's the company that runs Eureka Garden, the Section 8 housing complex in Jacksonville. That's tomorrow. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.